Welcome to Vashon 250, and episode number 21, the Declaration of Independence. Almost from the beginning of Vashon 250, we have discussed the many factors that ultimately led to the famous opening words, "We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal." In today's episode, we examine the Declaration of Independence. It is the founding document of the United States. On July 4th, 1776, it was adopted unanimously by the Second Continental Congress, who were convened at Pennsylvania State House, later renamed Independence Hall, and it's still there in the colonial city of Philadelphia. These delegates became known as the nation's founding fathers. The Declaration explains why the 13 colonies regarded themselves as independent sovereign states, no longer subject to British colonial rule, and has become one of the most circulated, reprinted, and influential documents in history. The colonies had been at war for a year prior to the Second Continental Congress, when King George III proclaimed them to be in rebellion on August 23, 1775. Congress appointed the Committee of Five to draft and present the Declaration. John Adams, Ben Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, Robert Livingston, and Roger Sherman were the five. Adams, a leading proponent of independence, persuaded the committee to charge Jefferson with writing the document's original draft, which the Congress then edited. Jefferson largely wrote the Declaration between July 11 and 28, 1776. The Declaration offered the political, moral, and legal justification for independence from the Kingdom of Great Britain. The Declaration justified the independence of the colonies, citing 27 colonial grievances against the king and asserting certain natural and legal rights, including a right of revolution. The Declaration was unanimously ratified on July 4th by the Second Continental Congress, whose delegates represented each of the 13 colonies. In ratifying and signing it, the delegates knew they were committing an act of high treason against the crown, which was punishable by torture and death. The Declaration of Independence has, over the last 250 years, become one of the most circulated, reprinted, and influential documents in history. It has proven to be an influential and globally impactful statement on human rights. Jefferson largely wrote the Declaration between June 11th and 28th, 1776. With that introduction, we have a special guest today.
My name is Nancy Bristow. I'm a longtime Vashon resident, though I realize 18 years doesn't really qualify me for that title. And I am a very recently retired historian of American history. So I am an emeritus faculty at the University of Puget Sound in Tacoma, Washington.
Go Loggers.
That's right. And it's just an absolute honor and pleasure to be here with the two of you.
Thanks for joining us. Bruce?
Well, it struck me that Jefferson's sort of writing of the Declaration of Independence is really an act of genius. There's lots of precedents out there. You know, there were lots of documents created in the American colonies leading up to it. But what Jefferson is able to do is to sort of pull together all these disparate sort of strands into one sort of incredibly concise statement of what this Declaration is all about. And it was interesting. I mean, Jefferson himself saw it, and he said it was a genuine infusion of the soul of our country. So he saw himself sort of capturing the sense of what America was about. And he said it was intended to be an expression of the American mind. So really an expression of who we are as Americans. And it has become a touchstone of our American democracy, even in times of real struggle. So what I find is interesting, and Nancy, jump in here a bit, but it's that sense of what Jefferson did is he combined two very powerful forces. One, sort of the Lockean concepts of natural rights and sort of the emerging concept of the individual and of individual rights with biblical conceptions. And so when you read the Declaration of Independence, you read a sentence like the opening, when in the course of human events, I mean, my God, that might as well, and God created the earth, right?
Right. And of course, they're endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, right?
Exactly.
So drawing on the Bible, drawing on the American, right, you know, foundation in religion, right, and really thinking through the importance of positioning the nation in that relationship,
sure,
but doing it right alongside the Enlightenment, right?
Exactly. Yeah, the two are marching in parallel, if you will. And he talks, Jefferson also talks about nature's God. So there's a spirituality and a spiritualism that sort of infuses this, but it often gets confused with Christian nationalism. And that's the sort of danger of the Declaration of Independence, because Jefferson was at best a heretic Christian.
At best.
If you've read the Jefferson Bible, you get a good sense of that. But these guys were men of God, if you will. They were very spiritual people, but they were not necessarily religious people. And that's an important sort of distinction when you read the Declaration of Independence. The other part of it, of course, are the very, very strong Lockean concepts, you know, the powers of the earth. We hold these truths to be self-evident. Laws of nature, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Governments are instituted among men, the consent of the governed, the right of the people to alter or to abolish a government. Man, these are powerful, powerful statements of the rights of individuals and the rights of a citizen.
And the rights of a citizen in community, right? So that this is the foundational ideology that will create nationhood. And as you suggested already, this is going to be something that will be hotly contested. What is really meant by, right, the consent of the government? Governed. What does it mean to be a government instituted among men? Even the notion of who constitutes the governed, right, is an ongoing battle that we'll talk about before we're finished today. But always this is done in the context of, as you suggested, this notion of us also as a people of God, which will come up and again be something that's really hotly contested, not just in the Bill of Rights, but right up through to the present day.
Yeah. And what's interesting to me about the Declaration is it's really two documents. I mean, it's this opening statement that we've been talking about that has this appeal to both the spiritual and to the rational enlightenment. But then the second part is really just a list of grievances. And that we'll come back to in a bit and talk about. But there's two of the grievances that are to me, of particular importance. One is the sort of opening of the frontier to attacks by, quote, what Jefferson wrote, merciless Indian savages. So what that does is build into the very foundational document of America, this concept of Indians as savages and the need to sort of suppress and conquer the continent. And it sets up a whole sort of two centuries of American westward expansion and manifest destiny, and the idea that native people are there just to be swept aside.
And that they are, in a sense, not even people,
right,
tragically.
Yep.
And of course, right alongside the naming of that is the absence of the naming of the realities of enslavement and the central role that that is playing in,
right,
the country.
Yep.
This notion of the assemblage of the horrors of slavery that gets dropped from the draft. Right, which will set a precedent then, right, of avoiding altogether engaging with and having that argument over what is going to be the place of enslavement in the context of people who are calling for the inalienable rights of men.
Right.
Right. They decide not to engage that at this moment. And you can understand, in a sense, the politics behind that.
Yeah. And that we still avoid that conflict, you know, and so that it's been embedded with in the American consciousness. And so I think the fact that Indians are designated as merciless savages, you know, that enslavement and slaves are totally left out of the Declaration, even though they're included in the Constitution as three-fifths of a person, you know, it really sets up sort of the tension of racial politics in the United States for the next 250 years, things that we're still dealing with today.
And the thing that is remarkable about that Constitution that I know will be a subject for a later episode, but it's worth mentioning again that the word slavery doesn't appear in that founding document.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Avoid it altogether.
Can we cut here? Just a quick second.
So, folks, there are numerous events over the last 250 years of American history that echo these events. Nancy, I'm going to ask you, what are some of the most significant of these in historic events?
Well, there are both international and domestic ramifications, and the use of the Declaration is, when I'm teaching my history students, I'll always say, you can just look for certain things that will always come up, the particular tropes, and one is the use of the Declaration of Independence and the actual language from there. On the international scene, almost immediately following the American Revolution, of course, is the French Revolution, which takes its inspiration, at least in part, from those events here in the United States. The ideals of the Enlightenment, as fraught as those can be, remember, we also get scientific racism from the Enlightenment, but these ideas of liberalism, of representative government, of opposition to monarchy and tyranny are ideas that are broadly embraced by those who feel that they should have more say in their governments. France, of course, is the next one to come in 1789. And though that revolution will take some turns that are quite unique relative to the United States, it's impossible to argue that it doesn't find inspiration in our founding documents, including, of course, the Declaration of Independence. One that I think is especially important to name today and any day is the revolution in Haiti, the one nation founded by formerly enslaved people who take it on themselves to engage in a war against their enslavers. It is a lengthy war. It lasts 13 years. It is tremendously violent, horrific war. It is a war in which the victors are ultimately penalized by the international community. When we look at Haiti today, we're aware that this is a nation with great problems domestically, not just political, but economic and social. The roots of that go back to the Haitian Revolution. Mm-hmm. Here are a people that overthrow their government, just as the United States, had its origins. Yet in the aftermath, the international community entirely turns its back on that particular revolution. The reason for that, of course, is fear over the reality of all of these other empires, that their own enslaved people will overthrow governments. And that's certainly the role that the United States will play in the aftermath. But we'll see this go on and on and on then across the decades, indeed over the centuries. In South America, we'll see the Spanish colonies rise up and engage one nation after another to found themselves, especially over the course of the 1820s. And then more recently, in the 20th century, this doesn't slow down, but in fact speeds up. So in the aftermath of World War I, we see the collapse of the four major empires, the Ottoman Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the German Empire, of course, which becomes the Weimar Republic, but also the Russian Empire. I'm clear on the idea that the USSR will become itself also an imperial force in the world, but we do see the collapse of the Tsarist Russian Empire in the wake of World War I. And then following World War II, of course, we have massive decolonization of both Asia and, following World War II, of course, we'll see the massive decolonization of both Africa and Asia. And here I want to pause for a moment to really acknowledge that as independence movements are forming and making their public case again and again and again, they use not just the ideas of the American Revolution, but the words of the American Declaration of Independence. Perhaps the most important one for us to name is the reality that Ho Chi Minh will be using the very words of the U.S. Declaration of Independence when he calls for the independence of Vietnam in 1945, claiming that because Japan has been defeated, that they should be given their independence also from France. The United States, of course, will choose not to follow that route. But in his words, he will quote directly the words of the American Declaration of Independence. And it's worth noting that even as early as World War I, Ho Chi Minh was making that case at the Paris Peace Conference in 1919, calling for the rights of the Vietnamese people. He used different language at the time, but calling for rights under the French, things like the right to free speech, to political voice, to education, to association. Exactly those things that we associate ultimately with the American Revolution. And this will continue on then with the decolonization of both Africa and Asia. We have the Atlantic Charter in 1941, which is an agreement right between Churchill and Roosevelt that calls for all people to have the rights to free speech, the right to free religion, the right to be free of want, and to be free of fear. And this is a foundational document then that leads to the 1948 Declaration of Human Rights. And this decolonization really rewrites the structures of world politics, because suddenly you have hundreds of nations declaring themselves independent and having the right then to representation in the world order. And that's, of course, going to happen right alongside the Cold War. So this is everybody's business. But then beyond the international, of course, Bruce, as you know, we've got a tremendous domestic use of the Declaration of Independence as different marginalized groups in the country make their own claims for the kind of rights that, you know, were called for in the Declaration of Independence.
Sure. Yeah. And that really begins in earnest in the 1820s, you know, with a sort of the 50th anniversary of the writing of the Declaration of Independence. All of a sudden, you start to see these sort of declarations of independence, declaration of rights, if you will. And one of those first is a memorial letter from the Cherokee Nation in 1829, sort of calling for their own independence. But you get in that same year, 1829, you get the first Working Man's Declaration of Independence. It just sort of takes word for word from our Declaration of Independence, but translates it into independence from monopolies and from big business and from business corporations. You get in 1936 during the Homestead Strike, you have the phrase, and I find this just fascinating, inalienable rights to organize into a great industrial union banded together with all our fellow steel workers.
Right.
Know? It's sort of like, man, you know, and that's, as Nancy talked about earlier, you see that language just repeated literally word for word all through the kinds of things that she's talked about internationally, but also domestically.
So if the steel workers are making that quotation in 1936, they've been at it for 50 years at this point.
Exactly.
And they finally find the right language, in a sense, to make their case in 1936. But we can look at other groups, right? So I think most of our listeners are familiar with the Seneca Falls Declaration of Sentiments in 1848, right, when women, over the course of 2 days, will debate the content of this declaration. Note the word declaration. It will include a list of grievances. Sound familiar? And including those will be sort of structural inequalities and the lack of the right to vote, all those things that they suffered as women through coverture, the idea that women were controlled by first their fathers and then their husbands.
Right.
How similar is that to the Declaration of Independence and the list of grievances all those years before?
And you get the same thing with John Brown's Declaration of Liberty. And it's not the Declaration of Independence, but it's a Declaration of Liberty for enslaved people. And leads to John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry and an attempt basically to end, you know, slavery through armed rebellion. Yeah. And of course, it's put down, but it's really a precursor to a war that would start 2 years later and sort of redefine what liberty means in the United States with the Civil War.
And right alongside that, you have to throw into the conversation Frederick Douglass and his famous speech, What to the Slave is the 4th of July,
exactly,
a calling out, in fact, that alternative voice that says, your holiday honestly does not work for me. He says, I shall see this day and its popular characteristics from the slave's point of view, and go on to say that this nation never looked blacker to me than on this 4th of July, because those rights are not being communicated to the full nation. In fact, the enslaved are suffering under it.
And that, to me, is the power of the Declaration of Independence. I mean, it's these overarching words and these overarching sentiments that are difficult to actualize, to make real, but at least they're the idea that they are goals for us to achieve. And that's been the struggle, I think, of American politics for the last 250 years, is to recognize and to realize the promise of the Declaration of Independence. And that's why, to me, the Gettysburg Address is such an important sort of document. You wanted us to stop?
Yep.
Oh.
Yeah, I don't.
Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, to me, is one of the great restatements of the principles of the Declaration of Independence, but also restating it in terms of broadening it. And when Lincoln says government by the people, of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from this earth. He's really opening up the concepts of the Declaration of Independence. The war itself, the Civil War, that is a sort of leads to the Gettysburg Address, is addressing those issues that are avoided in the original Declaration of Independence, the fact that it does not mention slavery, the fact that the Civil War is really a war over slavery and the continuation of slavery in the United States. And so the Gettysburg Address becomes this great restatement of the principles of the Declaration of Independence for a new world that emerges after the Civil War. And of course, as we've seen, that new world that emerges is not a perfect new world, and it's a world that goes through transitions with Jim Crow and the Civil Rights Movement and sort of a Trumpian sort of magma movement that we're in today. But at the same time, the principles are there, and the principles have been restated. And I think that's the significance of the Gettysburg Address.
Thanks, Bruce. Now let's look at current events. We live in crisis times. And what are some of the most significant events in the U.S. during the past 5 or 6 years that relate to the Declaration? To start this discussion, Nancy, give us a quote from the Declaration, and then Bruce, you have one as well.
Whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to effect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate the governments long established shall not be changed for light and transient cause.
Then the Declaration goes on and says, but when in a long... Declaration of Independence then goes on and says, but when in a long train of abuses and usurpations.
Words we don't daily use anymore. Yes.
I'm glad you got this one.
That's right. That's right. Yes. All right. Truman, can I start again? The Declaration goes on to say, but when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing I'm having trouble reading today. I'm sorry.
It's okay. I can do it if you want me to.
Barely the name, but these are weird.
Those are some good words you got.
The Declaration of Independence continues, but when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same objective evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. So what you have here are two statements, direct quotes from the Declaration of Independence, that I think give us an ability to step back and look at the current events that are going on in the United States, the current sort of abuses of power that are taking place, the current sort of collapse of the guardrails, if you will, that were designed in the Constitution that we'll come back and talk about in a future show. And so at what point do we as citizens of the United States begin to need to exert our influence and exert our opinions and exert our power as citizens, like the Declaration of Independence?
Yes, as so often has happened in the past, when people are uncertain about the actions of their government, there is this sense that one needs to lay out what the grievances are. And so perhaps we can talk for just a minute or two about what some of those grievances we see today are that really parallel some of those that were in the original Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, Nancy and I will read through. Here's a series of direct quotes from the Declaration of Independence of grievances they had against Britain and King George III. So the first was, he has refused his assent to laws. I mean, he has refused to obey the laws.
He has obstructed the administration of justice.
He has abused the courts, in effect. he has made judges dependent on his will alone. In other words, he has tried to influence the decisions of the courts.
He has kept among us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of our legislatures. I think we can all remember ICE and what took place just a few months ago.
He has elected a multitude. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people. Think about DOGE. think about the reorganization of the Department of War. Think about the Department of Defense into the Department of War. I mean, think about all the new administrations and new organizations that have come about, and the gutting of current, sort of past government organizations. So a multitude of new offices.
He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. And we've seen again and again his decision to remove leadership that, was long established and highly regarded by the actual professional military.
Yeah. I mean, the gutting of the Adjutant General Corps, the removal of officials who are designed to sort of watch over, government agencies. Mm-hmm. It's been an incredible sort of stream of removals of guardrails.
And two last ones, they complained for him about, and two last quotations, they complained that he had cut off our trade with all parts of the world.
Think tariffs.
Anybody know about tariffs? And he has finally excited domestic insurrections amongst us.
Yeah, if you think about what has happened in Minneapolis, what has happened in Chicago, what has happened with ICE raids around the nation. Again, that sense of the resistance is viewed as insurrection rather than as citizens standing up for their rights of free speech and free assembly.
So with that lead up, let's look at the grievances that were noted in the Declaration of Independence and see how they're relevant to our current situation with our current president and government, and discuss that a little bit. So as we look at Vashon events, Bruce, what are some of the Vashon events that echo these ideals of the Declaration of Independence?
Well, Vashon has 8 times attempted to exert its own independence from King County to break away and form either our own county or to be incorporated as a city or to join with another county. And then you have things like the 4th of July hydro race that's really not a race because you can't have a race and there's no sort of legal sort of standing for it, but it goes on every year. So I think Vashon has a long tradition of independence, if you will.
Maybe we ought to borrow Tom Jefferson's language more often just to make these things happen. So we're just a few days away from celebrating the nation's 250th birthday. And with that, we'd like to leave you with where the holiday came from. And it's largely attributed to John Adams, who wrote to his wife, Abigail. The second day of July, 1776, will be the most memorable epoch in the history of America. I am apt to believe that it will be celebrated by succeeding generations as the great anniversary festival. It ought to be commemorated as the day of deliverance by solemn acts of devotion to God Almighty. It ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations. From one end of this continent to the other, from this time forward, forevermore. One thing to note is he missed it by 2 days. It should have been the 4th day of July, but be that as it may, we can thank John Adams and Abigail for their commitment to a party. So in that spirit, we wish you a happy and festive 4th of July.